skin is black. My forehead low. My hair is woolly too. My back is strong. Strong enough to carry on after genocide and all my family gone. What do they call me? My name is Gutsinzi. Sticker. get me sick. What do they call me? A shadow. Starts to get steady, get day. Starts to get steady, get day. Starts to get steady, get day. Starts to get steady, get day.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we came out of the box tonight with the music of So Me, and we'll talk about So Me in a few seconds, but welcome to another edition of Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And we have an action-packed show for you today. We're going to be speaking with Archie Bell at 2:30. We're going to have an interview with Carol Boyce Davies out of the she's born in Trinidad and Tobago, but she's based in the U.S. and she travels around a bit. And she wrote a book called To the Left of Karl Marx, but she's not going to be talking about the book today. She's basically going to be talking about her life. But today, I want you to listen to all of the shows on Uhuru Radio. We have some action-packed shows. We have O'Malley Ishatella Speaks. We have Africa Live with D-Don Sankara. We have Reparations in Action, which is hosted by Penny Hess. We have Golden Sunday Sounds and Caribbean Forum. Ron Bob Simple is so nice, he has to be on the radio twice. And we have Black Agenda Report with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. And Uhuru Radio, I would like to thank two people, O'Malley Ishatella, Chairman O'Malley Ishatella, for giving me the space to do Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And Archie Shepp, who gave me the concept of Diasporic Music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And we broke a rule today because, I guess we broke it in a sense, but we played Sumi, and she is born in Indiana, but her parents are from Uganda and Rwanda. And she recorded at Four Women. She recorded the CD in Nigeria, and she has a CD called Lagos Salon. So she spent about 18 months in Lagos, and yeah, check her out. She's very, very, very a very, very important person. But right now, we wanted to celebrate the birthday of Roy Ayers. Roy Ayers was 74 a couple of days ago, and Roy Ayers was born in Los Angeles, California. He went to Thomas Jefferson High School, and Thomas Jefferson High School was the same high school that produced a lot of great African people and not so great African people. One of the people that went to one of the not so great African people that went to Jefferson High School was Ralph Bunche. Ralph Bunche was implicated in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. And Ralph Bunche is, in my judgment, was on the wrong side of history. Also, Jefferson High School produced Dorothy Dandridge, a great actress, and Johnny Guitar Watson, Barry White, Jesse Belvin, Etta James. One of the first schools that African people could go to in Los Angeles. But Roy Ayers and Fela recorded Africa, Center of the World, and Fela spent a year, maybe a little over a year, in Los Angeles, California, and he made friends with people like H.P. Barnum. He made friends with Roy Ayers, Don Cherry. Well, he knew everybody in Los Angeles, so we basically want to play Africa, Center of the World, and this is Fela, and it features Roy Ayers, who is just celebrated his 74th birthday. So remember, Africa is the center of the world.
Africa. you know. Say I go London to study 21 years ago.
You know.
I be student for London 21 years ago.
You know.
Englishman go they take his style, his style they touch my yash.
You know.
Englishman go they take it connie connie they feel my yash.
You know.
Englishman go they take it connie connie they feel my yash.
You know.
Do you know?
Why?
Do you know?
Why?
Why Englishman they like to touch my yash?
Why?
Then they like to touch my yash? Behind my back?
Why?
Do you know?
Why?
Do you know?
Why?
That is the reason.
Ignorance.
They say I get it till.
Ignorance.
Like monkey till.
Ignorance.
You see what I mean?
Ignorance.
Ignorant action.
Ignorance.
Built on wrong education.
Ignorance.
Wrong information.
Ignorance.
White supremacy.
Ignorance.
Built on ignorance.
Ignorance.
Western civilization.
Ignorance.
Built on ignorance.
Ignorance.
Them say I get it till. Like monkey tail.
Ignorance.
Wrong information.
Ignorance.
Now enlightenment, now him we day now.
Enlightenment.
Now him we day now.
Enlightenment.
Everybody he know.
Enlightenment.
Plenty white men know.
Enlightenment.
African are the greatest race.
Enlightenment.
Grey hat black race.
Enlightenment.
Plenty books to he talk em.
Enlightenment.
I don't need to who talk em.
Enlightenment.
African sold no slaves.
Enlightenment.
They came with ships and guns.
Enlightenment.
That is why do they.
Enlightenment.
They call us third world.
Enlightenment.
We are no third world.
Enlightenment.
We have been always first.
Enlightenment.
Plenty books to hit to come.
Enlightenment.
I don't need to go to come.
Enlightenment.
All I need to say is to set your minds to Africa. Africa is center of the world. Check your world map and see. 0 degrees down and across. Strongest people always occupy the best place anywhere. We are cleverest people to have occupied Africa. Best land, climate and people. You have to be strongest,
of course,
to occupy center of the world. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Of course.
You have to be strongest.
Of course.
To occupy center of the world.
Of course.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Of course.
You have to be wisest.
Of course.
To occupy
center of the world.
Of course.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Of course.
You have to be wisest.
Of course.
To occupy center of the world.
Of course.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Wisest, of course,
to occupy center of the world.
Of course,
yeah, 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 yeah.
Of course,
you have to be cleverest.
Of course,
to occupy center of the world.
Of course,
ooh, ooh, ooh.
Of course,
you have to be spiritual.
Of course,
to occupy center of the world.
Of course,
yeah, 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 yeah.
Of course.
That is the reason why I say, set your minds to Africa. Everybody sing with me.
Set your minds to Africa.
I say, everybody sing with me.
Set your minds to Africa.
Black people all over the world.
Set your minds to Africa.
Black people all over the world.
Set your minds to Africa.
African Americans.
Set your minds.
African West Indians.
Set your mind to Africa.
Africans in England.
Set your mind to Africa.
Africans in Europe.
Set your mind to Africa.
Africans in Brasilia.
Set your mind to Africa.
Africans all over the world.
Set your mind to Africa.
We need Pan-Africanism.
Set your mind to Africa.
We need Pan-Africanism.
Set your minds to Africa.
I say set your minds to Africa.
Set your minds to Africa.
I say black people all over the world.
Set your minds to Africa.
Pan-Africanism we need.
Set your minds to Africa.
I say Pan-Africanism we need.
Aisha, hold on. I'll walk with you. You know, this is going to be a great class.
I know. Yet I'm still trying to figure out how I can exactly use these skills.
The Uhuru Movement.
The Uhuru Movement?
Yes, the Uhuru Movement. They offer great opportunities to utilize these type of skills in the most meaningful ways. I mean, writers, photography, graphic design, journalism, videography, video editing, even radio broadcasting.
Wow. Sounds great. I'm assuming you have to be pretty advanced.
Not at all. I mean, although experienced is welcome, it's not mandatory. You know, the Uhuru Movement, they will train you. Log on and sign up today at uhurunews.com, where your skills are wanted and needed. Whether reporting on local news, writing for an international newspaper, or hosting your own radio show, the Uhuru Movement is the place for you. Do you have a desire to work in sales, marketing, or administration? Do you have the talent for audio engineering? Log on and sign up today, uhurunews.com. Not just explaining the world, but changing the world.
Thank you, brother. I will definitely follow up today.
and hopefully you'll become a member like I am.
Information, ideas, reality. That's what the Burning Spear newspaper offers you each month. Truth about government, society, entertainment, and the world around you. The Burning Spear is the oldest Black Power newspaper in existence, and your one-year subscription is only $25. Get the insight and perspective that the mass media machine cannot and will not deliver. Read dynamic articles on the most pressing issues affecting the lives of African workers in the U.S., Africa, and around the world. Each month, you'll find real political analysis of the crisis of parasitic capitalism, insight into world and local events, and a focus on the realities and struggles in the heart of the hood, expressing the vision and voice of the African working class. Uncompromising truth, unwavering focus. The Burning Spear newspaper. This is Black Power in the 21st century. Subscribe today and don't get fooled again. Order your subscription now. Go to burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. That's burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. Uhuru.
Alafia, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we were listening to the music of Fela Kuti featuring Roy Ayers, a song called Africa, Center of the World. And Roy Ayers has celebrated his 74th birthday. And we are going to have a play some great love songs at 3 o'clock. We have the Dramatics, Lenny Williams, Patti LaBelle, and Bobby Womack, some David Ruffin, some Rick James, and some Tina Marie, from 3 to 3:30. And from 3:30 until 4, we're going to have we have a documentary on Carol Boyce Davies, a woman born in Trinidad and Tobago who wrote a book called To the Left of Karl Marx. But she's going to basically be talking about her work. And it looks like we cannot find Archie Bell, so we're going to present a documentary on Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. And Nkrumah would have been 110 years old, or would have been 110 years old on September the 21st. So we found this documentary, Black Power, the Kwame Nkrumah documentary. We're going to give you, 25 minutes of that and come back, do the love zone, come back and talk to the sister from Trinidad and Tobago, Carol Boyce Davies, and Diasporic Music continues. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalal, and keep listening to Diasporic Music on the Uhuru Radio. Also, Chairman O'Malley Ishitella will be speaking on dialectical materialism at after this show is over, and we recommend that everyone listen to that particular show. Dialectical materialism is a very, very important it's very important that African people understand dialectical and historical materialism. And one last thing I would like to say is that the Christians have a saying called, if the good Lord is willing and the creek don't rise, and the Muslims say, inshallah, or God is willing, if there's anyone that can give me an African proverb which says basically the same thing, please email me at norman.o.richmond@gmail.com. Like I said, the Christians say, if the good Lord willing and the creek don't rise, and the Muslims say inshallah, which is God is willing. I want to know an African proverb which basically says the same thing. That African proverb could be from North Africa, East Africa, South Africa, Southern Africa, or West Africa, because I'm a Cape to Cairo man. I'm not only a Cape to Cairo man, I'm a Cape Town to Nova Scotia man, African people, wherever African people are, the Pacific Islands, islands, so on and so forth. But let us go to Black Power, the Kwame Nkrumah documentary.
Thirty-five years ago, one man set out to turn this country into a modern industrial utopia. He was Kwame Nkrumah, the first leader of a newly independent black African state. His aim was to transform Ghana into a society shaped and driven by the power of science.
And I see and hear springing up cities of Ghana, becoming the metropolis of science, learning, scientific agriculture and philosophy. Seek ye first the political kingdom, and all other things shall be added unto it.
We are a nation for our home. We supply power to every home. We are a nation for our home.
At the heart of Nkrumah's plan was a giant dam that would produce vast quantities of cheap electricity. Enough power to build a modern industrial state in the heart of Africa within a generation. But what Nkrumah did not foresee was that with the dam would come other, more dangerous forms of power which he could not control. Political and economic forces that would tear apart his vision of using science and technology to create a model for the new Africa.
Nkrumah was, in my mind, a visionary, not a dreamer. In his mind's eye, he could see United States of Africa as United States of America, and he could see Africa coming together to form a viable unit, to become a world power in the shortest possible time.
There is a new African in the world!
He needed power, and there was no source from which he could get the amount of power which he needed. And this was the one source which could provide him with that power. And he was prepared to go the whole length to get it.
We begin in West Africa, one of the two great areas of the world where we have ruled but never settled.
To the people of the Gold Coast, there came last week a day that will always be remembered in their history. For here, in what's been a British colony for more than a century, nearly a million people went to the polls in their first general election. The main issue in the election lay between those who want self-government sometime in the future and those who want it now, like the Convention People's Party, the CPP. Their leader, Kwame Nkrumah, spent election day in jail, serving a sentence for incitement and sedition.
Nkrumah's rise had been irresistible. After spending 10 years in America as a student, he had returned to the Gold Coast in 1947. Within 2 years, he had formed a political party. 2 years after that, he swept to power. Although the British still controlled trade, defence and foreign policy, he had become the first black African prime minister.
Nkrumah, before coming into power, has, in his election manifesto, had made certain promises about development, about turning the country into a modern industrial country. Nkrumah very much believed that for development, power was necessary, that you had to have power, that without power, you couldn't develop.
Power meant electricity, and the source was to be the giant Volta River that flowed through the eastern half of the country. Ever since the 1920s, the British had planned to build a dam there. A hydroelectric plant would produce electricity to make aluminium from the Gold Coast's vast reserves of the mineral bauxite. In the early 50s, Britain was desperate for a cheap source of aluminium, and Nkrumah joined with the British to resuscitate the scheme.
This is the Volta, the greatest natural resource of the Gold Coast, whose latent power is the mainspring of the most visionary development project in the whole of Africa. And this is bauxite, which lies in millions of tons beneath the green forested hills of the Gold Coast. From this red earth, man can extract the shining wonder metal of today, aluminium. And that is the aim of the Gold Coast, to cap the march to independence with a dramatic leap into the age of technology.
The British authorities saw the power from the dam simply as a means to boost the empire's supply of aluminium. But for Nkrumah, it was much more. He saw it as the key to fulfilling his country's destiny.
The power was originally conceived just for the manufacture of aluminium in this country. But then when Kwame came, he gave a new accent, a new importance to that power project. That was, the power was to be used for a comprehensive economic development of the country.
Together, Nkrumah and the British organized a traveling exhibition to promote the Volta scheme. Large models of the dam were built and taken around the country amidst a blaze of publicity. The exhibition was seen by nearly 2 million people.
Some elderly folks, their reaction was first, is it possible, is it feasible for this to happen in their lifetime? And I remember in one particular place, there was one farmer who came in a plot and did ask the question, what can he do to help for the project to come on?
The two mobile cinemas ranged the country ahead, showing films to audiences large and small, wherever they could find them. Showing how great rivers can create prosperity for the people who live beside them.
The exhibition was a great success, and it helped Nkrumah consolidate his political position. But to his opponents, whom he had defeated in the election, the Volta scheme was a dangerous trap. Just another cycle in the British exploitation of their country.
The British people were anxious to give us that scheme. And one thing I must make clear, the scheme was not started by Nkrumah. The Volta River scheme was an old scheme of a British government.
In 1953, Nkrumah's opponents forced a debate in Parliament. In a series of speeches, the opposition MPs warned that Nkrumah was in danger of enslaving the country to powerful interests far beyond his control.
As a long-term scheme, it is excellent. But as a short-term scheme, Mr. Speaker, it is suicidal. I would say that no nation which is beginning to free itself puts its neck in a position in which it will find itself in economic slavery.
At the end of the debate, Nkrumah defended his partnership with the British. We are not boys, he said. Do you think I am a fool to enter into a project like this blindly? I am not so damn silly as to put my nose into something that is detrimental to this country.
All my life, I've been a man of peace, working for peace, striving for peace, negotiating for peace. But I'm utterly convinced that the action we have taken is right.
In 1956, Britain invaded Egypt to prevent President Nasser from nationalizing the Suez Canal. Within 10 days, the United Nations and the Americans forced them to retreat. Suez symbolized the decline of Britain's colonial power. Vast projects like the Volta Dam began to look increasingly insecure in the face of confident new African leaders. And Britain was running out of money. That same year, Nkrumah's government was told the Volta scheme was shelved.
Nkrumah had received the news that the British government intended to pull out of the scheme because the finances were getting too large for them to handle.
He was almost in despair. Everybody was depressed. All of those of us who were involved in it in any way were shattered when we discovered that the project was on the shelf. And Nkrumah, but Nkrumah was not a man to allow depression to take over.
On the 6th of March 1957, the Gold Coast became Ghana, the first black African country to be free.
Ghana, your beloved country, is free forever. We are going to demonstrate to the world, to the other nations, young as we are, that we are prepared to lay our own foundation.
Out of the darkness, the pledge and the promise.
The promise of independence was not just going to be just freedom, but that people will see it in their lives. A promise that we are going to industrialize the country as a means of generating growth, economic growth. And industrialization means that we must have power And therefore, the first thing was that all of us should harness all our resources to get the power established.
It was a glorious moment for Ghana and for Nkrumah. But in private, he knew that many of the promises on which he had been swept to power might prove dangerously hollow if the dam were not built. It was the key to his vision of leading Africa into a shining tomorrow.
Freedom! Freedom! Freedom!
But then, 4,000 miles away, a simple twist of fate brought the Volta scheme back to life. At the end of 1957, Nkrumah's finance minister, Komla Bedema, went to America on a private visit.
I was invited to Maryland State College to give a talk on the newly independent Ghana. And as I was driving there from New York, I felt like having a drink of orange juice or water at a roadside restaurant, Howard Johnson's restaurant in Delaware. My secretary, who was an American, a black American, told me, "Minister, I think this is one of the states where they are very sticky about color." I said, "What?"
The home of good, good food is Howard Johnson's.
Howard Johnson's is such a friendly place to have good food.
I asked for two glasses of orange juice. The girl looked at us, said, "No, sir, you can't." I said, "What? You can't." Then she turned away, went in and told the manager to come and speak to us. So the manager came and said, "Gentlemen, I'm sorry, because of your color, you can't drink in here." And I said to him, "Look, there are people here who are lower social status than I am, but they can drink and I can't. Okay, you can keep the orange juice and the change, but you haven't heard the last of this." Next morning, it was world news all over the world.
Well, during the course of breakfast with the president, he wanted to know how it all happened, so I told him...
During breakfast, he asked me, "What were you doing in the United States?" I said, "I've come here to talk about the Volta project." "How's that project?" he asked. I said, "Well, we've put it in cold storage because we can't find the money immediately." "Have you talked to the State Department?" he said. "No, we haven't." "Dick, Richard, will you take care of that?" And that was how the Volta project came back to life so soon.
Nkrumah seized the opportunity. He wrote to Eisenhower asking for help in building the dam. Eisenhower invited him to visit America. At their meeting in March 1958, he told Nkrumah that the best way to get the scheme started again would be to involve American industry.
The Kaiser Aluminum Hour.
Eisenhower contacted Edgar Kaiser. He was head of one of the largest aluminium corporations in the world.
Kaiser Aluminum, the bright star of metal.
Kaiser was based in Oakland, California. It had mines and smelting plants throughout the world. It promoted aluminium as the shining, lightweight metal of the future.
Presenting aluminum, in a demonstration of those remarkable properties that have made it the favorite of millions. Aluminum is famed for its lightness.
At Eisenhower's request, Edgar Kaiser flew from California to meet Nkrumah in New York.
We were staying at the Waldorf Towers, and Edgar came in, and he and Nkrumah stood and looked at each other, and some kind of magnetic quality passed between them. It was quite remarkable. They took to each other at once. And I doubt if that electricity ever evaporated throughout their experience, although they had many set twos in one way or another.
Today, Ghana is a land of the future. Accra's international airport serves the major airlines.
At the end of 1958, a team of Kaiser executives and engineers flew to Accra to look at the plans for the scheme.
And at the end of the journey, a modern city.
Welcoming Nkrumah offered the Kaiser team a deal. If they agreed to build an aluminium smelter in Ghana, then his government would be able to raise the money for the dam. In return, the dam would supply the large quantities of electricity needed by the plant. The rest would go to power the future industries of the new Ghana. To the Kaiser team, Ghana seemed an attractive prospect.
It was wealthy. I think they had $400 million in the bank. Very highly educated. Everyone, every driver was reading the newspaper. I mean, they were very literate people. And it was as good a place to try in Africa as you could go to.
They were aggressive. There was one young lawyer who impressed me, who became great friends, Ron Sullivan. He was very aggressive, and they were later on got to understand what they were doing. That was their nature. Unlike the British, who were very gentlemanly, the Americans were straight to the point and no frills or wrapping up the... They call a spade, and a shovel.
They wanted the dam. And we were the means to get it, because we were the way that the dam was being financed.
It had always been assumed by the Ghanaians that, as with the British scheme, the smelter would use the vast reserves of their own bauxite, and so create an important new industry. But in the middle of the negotiations, the Kaiser team made it clear they had no intention of using Ghana's bauxite for the time being. Instead, they would import the raw materials needed by the smelter from America. The decision shocked the Ghanaian negotiating team.
They might have been disappointed, but you have to realize that wasn't that high grade of bauxite. It was high 30s or low 40s, and the bauxite, for example, over in Guinea was 55%. Makes a lot of difference in cost. It just wasn't possible at that time.
This seemed to be totally wrong to Nkrumah. He was intensely upset. He could never believe that Ghana's bauxite couldn't be converted by a series of processes into pots and pans and roofing sheets.
What the Kaiser executives didn't tell the Ghanaians was that there was another reason why they didn't want to use the local bauxite.
We were greatly concerned that if we located within Ghana all of the bauxite and power necessary to have an integrated aluminum operation, that someday our project, if it were profitable, might be nationalized by the government and taken away from us.
The Kaiser team refused to change their minds. They knew, as well as Nkrumah did, that without them there would be no dam. At the end of 1959, Nkrumah told his team to agree to Kaiser's terms. Millions of dollars worth of Ghanaian bauxite would remain in the ground. But with Kaiser's letter of intent in his pocket, Nkrumah knew he could now set about raising the money to build the dam. He approached the World Bank. It had been set up at the end of the war to provide loans to rebuild Europe, but now it had turned its attention to the Third World. He asked the bank for £30 million. It was the largest loan ever requested. Yet the bank's economists believed, as Nkrumah did, that electricity was the key to industrial development in the Third World.
We envisage the development of this power resource as fundamental to Ghanaian economic development. The provision of power, electric power, to Ghana was an immense economic benefit to the country, was a sine qua non of economic development in the country. So let's accept that the economic benefits for power to Ghana were tremendous.
The belief that science and technology applied on a grand scale would somehow inevitably propel a third world country into the industrial age was the prevailing wisdom of the time. It was called the theory of takeoff. It gripped the imagination of politicians and economists both in the West and in the Third World. In June 1960, the World Bank approved the scheme in principle, but its report had important reservations. The most serious concerned the price Kaiser paid Ghana for electricity. The World Bank made it clear that if Nkrumah was to get the benefits he expected from the dam, he must negotiate a certain minimum rate for the power. If he didn't, Ghana might find it difficult to take off.
Our report essentially was saying to Ghana, this project will succeed and we're prepared to make a loan on it, and the loan can be paid out if the power price is right. This was absolutely the key to the negotiations.
As a conductor of electricity, it's hard to beat.
But Kaiser needed a low rate if the smelter was to be profitable. A second round of negotiations began.
In toughness and adaptability, it can be made as strong as structural steel.
And Krumer faced a terrible dilemma. His advisors and the World Bank told him that if he accepted the price Kaiser was offering, the high expectations he had of the dam might not be realized. But if he refused, and Krumer knew that Kaiser would pull out, and the dam would never be built.
Krumer was a man besieged. He had to do something. As you know, he had raised up hopes of the development of the country, that the Volta River project would turn Ghana into a modern industrial country. He had no other program. Insofar as he saw it as providing this minimum of the power which he saw, he was prepared to go along.
The negotiations dragged on through the autumn of 1960. Neither side would give way on the electricity price. Finally, one hot afternoon in December, Edgar Kaiser decided to confront Nkrumah and force the issue.
Kaiser asked for the meeting to be adjourned and went straight to Nkrumah and explained that perhaps his shareholders would not go along with the project if we asked for a higher power rate than Kaiser was asking for. A message came back after lunch, direct from Nkrumah, that we're to go ahead and accept the rate. He wanted the project at all costs.
Kwame Nkrumah and Edgar Kaiser on the 22nd of January 1962 signed the master agreement, which enfolded every provision that was necessary between Edgar Kaiser's company and the Ghana government. When they had signed it, they stood up and clasped each other in a very, very genuine embrace. I was there together with a large number of other distinguished guests, and I don't think any of us will ever forget it. The following day, we all went to Akasombo, and Nkrumah let off a vast charge, and the scheme started.
Yes, I suppose you can say Kaiser used Nkrumah, but if that makes Nkrumah passive, that would be inaccurate, because Nkrumah also used Kaiser. The question is, whose end of the bargain came out better? Nkrumah would seem to have been going into an area with so many unknowns. One can say that while he was pursuing power, power slipped through his fingers.
But even as Nkrumah and Edgar Kaiser celebrated, other forces were becoming involved in the scheme. The dam was now a hostage in the vicious confrontations of the Cold War. A year before, the Congo had been torn apart by a brutal civil war. America and the Soviet Union backed opposite sides. The policy of the new Kennedy administration was to fight the spread of communism in Africa. In 1960, Brezhnev, the president of the Soviet Union, had visited Ghana. It frightened America's leaders. They were determined that Nkrumah, despite his brand of African socialism, would be their man.
Nkrumah was everything. He was everything, politically, economically, psychologically, culturally, and so on. He just absolutely dominated the scene.
Nkrumah, though, wanted to keep Ghana and Africa out of the Cold War.
President and distinguished delegates, it's quite clear that a desperate attempt is being made to create confusion in the Congo, extend the Cold War to Africa, and involve Africa in the suicidal quarrels of foreign powers. The United Nations must not allow this to happen.
But there was the dam. The American government realized that it was a powerful weapon with which to ensnare Nkrumah. Like the World Bank, the Kennedy administration had agreed to lend millions of dollars to the scheme. In an internal memorandum, the Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, made it quite clear what this money was for. By maintaining this leverage on Nkrumah, he wrote, the US will be in a better position to influence his policies. In public, though.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. I am your bluesologist, and we just gave you some information about Nkrumah. The documentary is called Black Power, the Kwame Nkrumah documentary. You can check it out on YouTube. It's about 45 minutes, and good information, very good information. You can actually hear the voice of Osage for Dr. Kwame Nkrumah speaking, and we are happy to present that to you. Once again, Omali Ishitella, Chairman Omali Ishitella, will be speaking at Dialectical Materialism, and we urge everyone to give a listen. We need to learn about, we as a people, I should say Africans and all oppressed people, should attempt to learn about dialectical and historical materialism. But I'm asking the question, the Christians say, if the good Lord is willing and the creek don't rise, and the Muslims say, inshallah, or if God is willing, I am looking for an African proverb which says basically the same thing. It could be from North Africa, it could be from East Africa, from Southern Africa, or from West Africa. It could be from the Caribbean, because we could be from the South. We took a lot of our culture wherever we went. But I want an African proverb which says the same thing as the Christians and as the Muslim. If the good Lord willing and the creek don't rise, or inshallah, if God is willing. What is the African proverb that basically says the same thing? We are going to play some music from the Dramatics. And the Dramatics featured, first of all, they feature a man by the name of Willie Ford on bass. And I don't think Willie Ford is related to Rob Ford, who is ill, and his brother Doug Ford is running for the mayor of Toronto. And there are many Fords. Glenn Ford, there were two Glenn Fords. Our Glenn Ford, who is a Black Agenda Radio, he's not related to Doug or Rob Ford. Or I don't know if he's really even related to Willie. But we're going to be listening to the Dramatics and I Panic, which featured L.J. Reynolds out front. We're going to be listening to Lenny Williams, Cause I Love You. And Lenny Williams was an honorary pole bearer for Huey P. Newton. He said the only reason he didn't join the Black Panther Party was because he couldn't afford a leather jacket. We also going to hear Bobby Womack featuring Patti LaBelle. Love Has Finally Come at Last. We're going to be listening to Rick James and Tina Marie Fire and Desire. And we're going to end our love zone with Davis Eli Ruffin. David Ruffin, Just Let Me Hold You for a Night. And Diasporic Music continues.
Put my phone to my ear. I dialed your number, let it ring, and still no one was there. When I ran to your house and found your room unoccupied, I checked the drawers and closet.
Fire, the passions, the feel. But I One time things got so bad until I had to go to one of my friends and talk to him. And I told him, I said, you know, I'm having problems with the woman that I love. It seems that I call her on the phone and I just can't get her to answer. And then I went to her house and I saw a car parked in the driveway. I knocked on the door, but still my knocks went unanswered. And then I went home and I watched television until television went off. And then I played my records until I just didn't want to hear them anymore. And finally I went to bed, but I found myself waking up a few hours later. And the tears were running down my face. And my friend told me, he said, Lenny, you just ought to forget about her. But I told my friend, I said, you know, maybe you've never been in love like I've been in love. And maybe you've never felt the things that I felt. But this is what I told my friend, I said, you know, sometimes you get lonely. You get lonely. You get lonely. Oh, 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 oh. And I cry. I cry. Oh, 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 oh. And the tears would fill up. In the wells of my eyes, oh baby. And then it got so bad, it got so bad. Till one time I thought I'd roll myself up in a big old ball and die. And then I met you, darling, and you smiled at me. Oh, oh, it was such a pretty smile, yes it was. And you reached out your hand. You help me. You help me. Yeah. Oh, I'm glad, baby. I'm glad, baby. Oh, 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 baby. I won't ever leave you, baby. I won't ever grieve you, baby. I'm gonna love you. Oh, oh. I'm glad, baby. Oh, oh. Yeah, baby. Oh, oh, oh. I love you. I love you. I love you. I love you. Oh, I love you. I love you. I love you.
But it's more
tripping out on the girls, body vibration. But I knew, oh, 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 oh yeah.
Love is how to come at last.
That's all I'm thinking about. Listen to me now. Just like a tender young bird and a first love affair, I doubt if she'd ever do it again, would she even care? But as I pressed on, ooh, the girl caught on. Now the more she do it, the more she seemed to
want it.
Treating you well. Oh, me?
Well, I've just been doing the same old thing I've always been doing. You know, I've got a new lady now, and it's a little different than it was when I was with you. You know, I think back to when we met, the way I used to be and that cold way I used to act. But more than that, I think of how you changed me with your love and sensitivity. Remember when I used to so quickly from a cold-blooded person thinking he's God's gift to women. Remember how I used to do that? I must have been crazy then. Remember when you used to I think we both said a little too much today.
No.
After all, O.T., you're kind of with somebody and I'm kind of living with somebody. But please do me a favor just before you go.
Baby.
Just put your arms around me and hold me like you used to.
I will hold you tight.
Tell me, Rick, everything's gonna be all right. Put your arms around. Put your arms around. Oh, baby. Oh, baby.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diet Sport Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, and we were playing the music of David Ruffin. David Ruffin, born in Why Not, Mississippi, spent some time in Memphis, Tennessee. Everyone knows he went to Detroit and made it as the lead singer of the Temptations. And for whatever it's worth, when he passed away, he was eulogized by Minister Louis Farrakhan. We also heard from Rick James and Tina Marie. And Roy Ayers was on playing vibes on that particular track, Fire and Desire. Tina Marie, a Euro-American out of California, sounding very good. And Bobby Womack and Patti LaBelle. Lily Williams out of Oakland, California, who said he'd been joining the Black Panther Party because he couldn't afford another black leather jacket. He was very close to Huey P. Newton and was an honorary pallbearer at Huey Newton's funeral. And we heard the Dramatics featuring the voice of L.J. Reynolds. And we are getting ready to have to close the show. And we have a documentary from a sister by the name of Miss Boyce Davies. We're going to play this interview, but before we play the interview, this woman has written a book on the To the Left of Karl Marx, and she's not going to talk about that particular book. Gloria Boyce Davies and Dr. Robert Hill, who taught in Cal. He's a Jamaican, and he is the administrator of all of Marcus Garvey's writings. He was teaching at UCLA, and he said that Gloria Boyce Davies came to speak at UCLA on Claudia Jones, and he said there was not one African from the African continent, not one African from the Caribbean, not one African from America. They were all Euro Americans and Latinos that came to hear Gloria Boyce Davies. But we wanted to introduce you to Gloria Boyce Davies, and we will be playing a lot of her work, and we also plan to get her on the show. But this is Gloria Boyce Davies out of Trinidad and Tobago. Give her a listen.
Minutes past the hour of 2 o'clock. You're tuned to Songs of the Caribbean. I am Jeanette Drew, aka the Duchess. And in the studio with me, we have Dr. Carol Boyce Davies, Professor of English and African New World Studies. And good morning to you, Dr. Carl.
Good morning. Good morning, South Florida. Good morning, whoever is listening to us.
And welcome to Songs of the Caribbean. It's a pleasure to have you here.
It's so lovely to be here as well. And I want to compliment you on keeping the music, keeping the culture fresh, and a lot of times, you know, tuning to WLRN at this time, one is really blessed to have this kind of music coming through the airways. And I'm sure many people feel the same way.
Okay. But in the introduction, I mentioned that you are the professor of English and African New World Studies.
Well, yes. Let me clarify. Actually, at the end of June, which is 3 days or 4 days ago, today's July 5th, I terminated my time at FIU. So I'm professor of Africana Studies and Comparative Literature at Cornell University now, beginning July 1. So I'm really pleased to have served this community for 9 years. And in that capacity, helped develop the African New World Studies program at Florida International University so that it became an internationally recognized program. And we were able in that capacity to really advance a great deal of African diaspora culture with particular programming such as the Eric Williams Memorial Lecture, Malcolm X Ilobeka Lecture, and a series of conferences, programs. We developed a master's program and wanted really to find a way to make sure South Florida became a site for African diaspora studies. And we were able to do that.
Okay. You studied, you're from Trinidad and Tobago, born in
Born in Trinidad and Tobago, Barataria, to be exact. Actually born in Curep, a place called Curep, which I learned now is actually pronounced Curepe. If you go to Brazil, that's how it sounds when it's said. And grew up in Barataria, San Juan area. And Barataria is about 4 miles from Port of Spain. And more now, it's almost like an extension of Port of Spain because one can get there very quickly. But when I was growing up, it seemed quite a long way. So it's a pleasure whenever I go home. It's quite a joy to see the distances really collapsing and you realize you're really on a small island.
Oh, dear.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what was it like growing up in Jamaica?
In Trinidad. It was
Trinidad,
wonderful. Right, there we go. Trinidad was, I think I should say that I came of age at a time when we were moving out of the older formations, which were colonial, and into an independent Trinidad and Tobago led by Dr. Eric Williams. And this is why I would imagine somebody like him would have that kind of impact. And that's significant because at that time, we were sort of trained to be really proud of coming from the Caribbean. And education was absolutely so critical in that process. And the kinds of phrases that you would hear on the radio was that education is going to be the tool towards helping us succeed as a nation and as a people. So that's been drummed in the heads of, I think, almost every Caribbean person of my generation, that you really have to get the most education you can get, take it to the top, as it were. And because of that, I feel I've been able to be successful. So I thank all those teachers and family members and neighbors who made sure I stayed in school, went to school, and who supported my attempts to get as far as I could get with my education. And along with that, in coming of age and independence, was a great pride in being Caribbean. Williams used to have something called University of Woodford Square, and I was a child then, but you could listen on the radio and you could see parents really wrapped up following intellectual arguments and debates about what was going on in the world at that time and so on. And I think that, along with that sort of turning towards, you know, raising children who were going to be smart and educated and so on, shaped the kind of person I am today, and therefore a kind of commitment to always giving back to community, but also a sense of really making sure you prepare another generation as well to come forward. And that's the nicest part of it, I think.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So were you told directly of the importance of education, or what was expected of you, or did you was more observation and you?
I think a combination of it, because and I think there's still that to today. We, for example, at FIU developed something called the Grenada Teachers Institute, And we would take teachers from the South Florida area to Grenada, and they would study the schools, spend some time observing different types of schools, Catholic, you know, public, and so on, country, you know, rural schools, urban schools. And I remember once we went into a classroom, and the entire classroom stood up really quickly. And many of the teachers were shocked. They were wondering what was going on. And then they realized that in the Caribbean, in that particular Caribbean school, that children are taught that if a teacher comes in or if adults who are visiting come into the room, you need to stand and acknowledge them. And in other words, there's a larger culture which supports kind of joy and respect for education and people who are in the educational process. So the answer would be yes, through observation, but also through cultural teachings. And social teaching, civics, I guess, is the word that they're looking for in the U.S. to bring that back, so that children and adults learn what's going on in their communities and also are educated about ways to be in the world in a positive kind of way. And that's really missing in the current climate in which we live. The only way you may get some of that is probably television, but the respect for teachers is kind of on the way out, it seems. We lose a lot, I think, if that doesn't happen. So the governmental, I think it was a governmental policy. It was really clear that that was policy because Williams repeated it over and over again. But family really also valued education and made sure that the children got educated. And even when I moved to the U.S., and I was going to university, you would run into adults who would say, well, you know, what do you know? You know, and they would sort of test you, like, do you know about Marcus Garvey? Do you know about this one? Do you know about that one? So, and if you didn't, they'd be like, what are you learning in these universities? I think we need to bring back some of that, actually.
Okay. And universities, I see that you have studied in Africa as well as
yes.
in the U.S.
Right. I went to University of Maryland in Eastern Shore, and that was quite an experience because it was in the middle of what would be called the Black Power period, where we would have people like Stokely Carmichael and so on very prominently as role models. And then Howard University, where I did a master's in Africana studies, African studies, actually. And then after that, I got a scholarship from the government of Trinidad and Tobago to study African literature in Nigeria under something that was called the Commonwealth Scholarship Program, which was actually quite prestigious then. I don't think they really exist anymore. But basically, it covered everything. And I tell people I probably had more money then than I have now as a working person, because it covered everything, travel, tuition, spending money. And they used to hand us up spending money in cash. It was not like you had a check and you went to the bank. They would give you like whatever the money was, 500 or whatever, Naira. Naira is the Nigerian currency. And it was given in cash. And in that experience of living in Africa at that time, and keep in mind, that was a time when many people wanted to go back to Africa, and there was this desire to really know what the continent was like. So being able to study there was quite significant. And being there at that time as well exposed me to somebody who was studying African literature, to actually meeting the writers. So I was able to meet people like Chinua Achebe in Nigeria, or Wole Soyinka, or Amos Tutuola, Amata Edu, and many of the major named writers. So I felt like I got a really significant learning experience in Africa. And then along with that, of course, as a normal graduate student, got on the road and traveled by road with friends to, all the way to Mali, Niger, and all those places, hitchhiking. And now you wonder, my God, that was pretty reckless to do that.
I was just about to ask you.
Yeah, we went all across the West African coast by road, and then went north another time, and all the way, I mean, to Ivory Coast, stopping in different places and checking out those little places, little villages that you wanted to really see. And always people were so welcoming. I remember once going through from Ghana to Ivory Coast, and we crossed at the northern end. And when the guy saw my Trinidad passport, he called everybody because he had never seen it. seen a passport from Trinidad and Tobago before, or anywhere in the Caribbean. And he kept saying, where is this place? Where is this place? And he was speaking French, of course, and trying to explain. And I had to say Jamaica, because they understood Jamaica. I said, Jamaica, Bob Marley. Oh, he said, ah, Les Antilles, you know, Caribbean, you know. So that was an amazing thing. And he called, and he was so happy to really see somebody from that part of the world. And, of course, you know, there's always this curiosity about where are you from? And when you when they realize who we are, you know, like the children of the descendants of Africans who were sent over there, they're like, wow, you came back, you know.
So what are their views of Caribbean people of African descent? Are they curious? Do they ask a lot of questions about us?
I met old people who couldn't figure it out, you know, and they kept saying, where are you from? And you would say, where? And they would say, well, they think it's still a part of Africa that you're talking about.
Okay.
If they don't have a good global sense. And then, you know, you try to convince them. When they know, you have to really take them back to that knowledge of Africans who were sold into enslavement and transported across the continent. And then there's a great deal of sadness when they realize that this is that group. So you have a range, you have a mix. The knowledge they have of the Caribbean, even today, is still driven, and that's the nice thing I think about what you do, by the music. They know Bob Marley, regardless. And I, for example, I spent a lot of time in Brazil. I'm jumping ahead, and a lot of the Brazilians did not know the, you know, English language, but they knew what Bob Marley was saying. They could understand from his rhythms and from the sounds he made that he was speaking to them. So this is why culture and music is so significant, because beyond language, you're able to communicate who you are. And this is why when I said Bob Marley, reggae music, or Jamaica, they understood. And of course, Jamaicans have always had the lead in terms of early migration, so people knew about that. But then subsequently, they knew also about people like Mighty Sparrow and Kitchener. They all knew Kitchener because many people had studied in London and sent records back home to Nigeria. So great deal of curiosity and kind of welcoming. The most welcoming I found in that group was from Ghana, and that is also significant because Ghana is the place of Kwame Nkrumah and, you know, the first major country to get independence in Africa, but also because you had George Padmore from Trinidad and Tobago, who was a Pan-Africanist who worked in Ghana, was a major advisor to Kwame Nkrumah, and also remember Marcus Garvey and the Return to Africa, the star of Ghana, still has that black star in the middle for the Black Star Line, so they have that knowledge as well of that attempt of at least people like Garvey to reconnect and go back to Africa.
Okay, quite interesting. So how did you come to the decision of becoming a professor? Is that what you intended to do?
No, what a great question. Oh, dear. Actually planned to go to law school, and I was planning to do international law. And when I left undergraduate school, that was the intent. And I told somebody that, you know, going to study African studies at that time was very kind of something that I was doing in a way to kind of retool myself to go into law school. But of course, once I started to study African studies, I began to get more and more immersed in that whole vast area of knowledge. So Howard and African studies was really significant as a turning point in me in my own professional life. So instead of going to law school, I went to graduate school and did African studies. I should say that I did attempt to begin to do international law at American University. I was accepted there at American U and at Columbia. I chose American U so that I could be in D.C. And my first day or so, my first week of school was quite a revelation because I was the youngest person. I was, 22 or whatever. I had on hot pants. I remember that was hot pants I was in with Afro puffs or something. And the class was made up of diplomats who had already been on tour and who spoke like four languages. And I just said, I need to get out of here. And so it was a kind of international law program that I wasn't ready for. And I went to Howard, as I said, and did African studies and the rest is history. Then I got this scholarship to go to Nigeria. So, yes. But I need to say, though, and this is for young people listening, that because I always wanted to do international law, it was always something that was left undone. And in 2001, I went back to St. Thomas University right here in Miami.
Oh.
And did the master's in international intercultural human rights law and LLM. And I felt doing that, that I had sort of really completed what I wanted to do anyway, although it was not a law degree, but I find it very useful in my own work in terms of understanding what's going on in international law, all the various instruments that I use for different international law questions, human rights issues in particular, but also how I could integrate it into sort of studying women in a particular location. Or the question of women and leadership in international politics, which is something I'm really interested in. I look at people like Condoleezza Rice, the new woman like Portia Simpson Miller, and a whole range of women who are sort of beginning to make inroads into international politics as leaders. So those kinds of questions then begin to be very significant for me still. And I'm able then to use those interests and that knowledge to combine it with, you know, to advance my own knowledge. I think learning is an ongoing experience and one should never give up. So in other words, you know, I have students who at 20-something are telling me they can't do it or it's, you know, too hard. And I know people who went back to medical school when they were 42 and became medical doctors and are now making a lot of money, more than I do. So there's never an end to a learning process. And if you're listening out there, the one thing I want to leave with you, among other things, is that, no, keep going. And if there's a setback, if you have a baby or if you stop or if you got married or whatever, don't ever give up on whatever your dream is. Go back at it. Come back at it from a different angle. And I'm sure that if you do, you'll be rewarded really immensely by that.
Okay. So do you see yourself getting a degree in law? I mean,
No, I wouldn't. But I should never say no, eh? Because you never know. The kind of person I am, you never know. I did do the master's in law, but I don't think I'll do the JD. But if an opportunity arises and it looks like something I'd like to do, why not? You know, I think we should all be about really getting the max out of this world we live in. And whatever opportunities are presented, then we go for them. So, yes, who knows? Maybe I'll do that.
And you are an author?
I am, happily so. I do academic writing. I do have a children's story, which should be in press pretty soon, called Walking. It's about a man in my neighborhood who walked everywhere. And it's quite a funny story because he sort of preceded the kind of contemporary speed walkers. And people used to laugh at him and think he was crazy. He had a light on his head, as they would say, and so on. But he was always really more energetically walking. And again, as I said, Barataria to Portispin was only 4 miles. So this is a man who could make that in a short time. But the more recent book that I published is a book on a Caribbean woman who is the founder of what has become the Notting Hill Carnival in London. And your listeners may really want to pick up a copy because it's on Essence Magazine's bestseller list for July. It's number 3 in the nonfiction category. And that's really quite significant because it's an academic book. So it's doing really well. And it's published by Duke University Press. It's called Left of Karl Marx, The Political Life of Black Communist Claudia Jones. And it's called that, Left of Karl Marx, because if you go to London, Highgate Cemetery, she is actually buried to the left of Karl Marx. She died in 1964 and was buried left of Karl Marx. So as you stand looking at the Marx bus with a big sign that says Workers of the World Unite, on the left on a flat stone is Claudia Jones from Trinidad and Tobago. And we have to be really quite proud of this from the Caribbean, that here we have one of the major historical figures in the world, you know, major world figure. And right next to him is a Trinidadian woman buried, minus all the trappings, but really left of Karl Marx. So I used that as a way of trying to understand what she was about and what she tried to do. And I argue in the book that even though Karl Marx is identified as having the most radical philosophy as far as political economy and labor and workers' rights and so on, that a black woman advocating questions of race and gender in a similar kind of way and linked to the Communist Party as she was, it's actually ideologically left of Karl Marx. And that's why the title is as it is. And I think that's probably why it's so popular, because people want to know who is bold enough to to write a book that's called Left of Karl Marx. Who can be left of Marx? Marx is the ultimate left, right? So she is that person and really suffered for it. But she was born in Trinidad in 1915 and migrated to the U.S., to New York in 1924, and then ran right into U.S. Jim Crow experience of segregation and racial subordination, got involved in the Communist Party through something called the Scottsboro Boys Trial, which was a trial of 9 young boys, some of them as young as 12 years old, who were accused of raping a white woman. This was a major Communist Party event. And of course, they were innocent and were found so. But it took a 2 or 3 years to get them freed. But the Communist Party saw this as a major project, and Claudia got interested in that. She said she was also interested in listening to the street corner speakers. At that time, there were a number of street corner speakers talk about Mussolini and the invasion of Ethiopia. So those two major events then were like the catalyst for her getting involved politically. And she found the Communist Party's explanation the best. So she joins the Communist Party and became a journalist in the party, writing in all the youth papers and making her way up through the ranks to become associate editor and editor of the Daily Worker. And in that capacity, had a column for about 4 years in the 1950s called Half the World. And Half the World was meant to talk about women's experiences around the world. So she was way ahead of her time.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we're getting ready to close out, and I made a big, big mistake. Carol, it is Carol Boyce Davies, not Gloria. I have this Gloria on my mind. Maybe I'm thinking about the song Gloria by Enchantment, but Carol Boyce Davies, and she did talk about the book To the Left of Karl Marx. And another great Trinidadian who we should basically always remember is H. Sylvester Williams. H. Sylvester Williams actually lived in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and had something to do with he was a cricket man, and he also lived in South Africa, and he organized the first Pan-African Conference in 1900. And then William Edward Burkhart Du Bois organized the Pan-African Congresses after that, 5 Congresses after that. But H. Sylvester Williams, many regard him as the father of Pan-Africanism. I would like to thank Lisa Watson for her technical brilliance today. And we had everything was smoothly. We didn't get a chance to talk to Archie Bell again, but hopefully we'll get him someday. And we are preempted next week. There will be the Impidom Conference is going to be on next week. And I wanted to see you, say that I'll see you in the whirlwind, and we're going to end like we end every week with the music of John William Coltrane and Eric Allen Dolphy Jr., of course, from Los Angeles, California. So we will see you in the world. Take care.